So welcome, everybody. My name is Michael Moore. I'm a professor here at the Elliott School's Institute for International Economic Policy. I'll just give a couple words about the Institute and some initiatives that we are beginning this year. IIEP, as we know it, is a research organization at the Elliott School devoted to the study of international economics and development. We have four major initiatives at the Institute currently, including on ultra-poverty, on climate change, adaptation in developing countries, U.S.-China economic relationship, and a new one on global economic governance in the 21st century. This last one is particularly appropriate for the subject today because we are looking at various types of governance structures, institutions, regulations that govern financial and commercial relations across countries. Now, today we are here to talk about the euro. I guess this title here that Desmond Lightman will be talking about is as appropriate as any, because the euro has come under continued pressure in recent months. We had Desmond Lightman and Holger Wolf here in March or February talking about this issue, and so we had decided that enough to say for that for a while, but things have continued to be interesting. So one of the great things about being a professor of international economics, there's always something going on. And the euro in particular is a complicated one because it involves politics, it involves finance, economic realities, very complex relationships across countries. So I'm very much looking forward to the group of people we have here today to talk about this. So Desmond Lightman is at the American Enterprise Institute, formerly with the IMF, has written extensively on international financial issues. Holger Wolf is an associate professor at Georgetown University, works on the German economy, European economic issues, and also on international finance, including currency boards and various other mechanisms to govern economies' exchange rates. Fred Utz is a professor here at the GW's economics department, particularly focused on economic forecasting. So he will be able to tell us with precision exactly what's going to happen over the next 6 months. So get your iPhone out and make some trades based on what Fred tells you. Actually, don't. But he'll at least give you some ideas about some of the economic consequences going forward. We'll start out with three brief presentations, open it up to Q&A at the end. Desmond Lightman has to leave promptly at 1:20, so we will not go beyond that unless you have some questions at the very end. So let me turn it over to Desmond, and looking forward to your comments.
Great. I guess I've just demonstrated that I didn't belong in the 21st century. Thank you very much for inviting me again to talk about the euro. What I want to do is perhaps just start with a couple of conclusions and then, you know, go through a few slides that would try to substantiate my point of view. My point of view is that we're already right at the beginning of the unraveling of the euro. I think that I mentioned that in March, but I indicated at that time that it was difficult really to see the timing, you know, while eventually the way in which the euro has been structured, that it was bound to unravel. Now I think that we really are in the end game, and my view is that we'll see the euro unravel in 2012 in the sense that we'll have a number of countries defaulting on their debt and we'll have one or two countries exiting the euro. That'll cause all sorts of contagion. You'll have a banking crisis in Europe. So I start with that as a conclusion. The second point that I'd make right at the start is that this is going to have huge consequences for the United States, that one has to take into account that Europe is still the largest economic bloc in the world. It accounts for something like a third of global output. So if Europe falters in a bad way, that is going to be bad for United States exports. If Europe has a banking crisis, that'll be bad for the euro against the dollar. So it means that the United States has trouble exporting in third markets. But the most important connection, if we learned anything from 2008, 2009, is the financial market connection. The United States has huge financial exposure to the European banking system. People at Treasury will tell you that we don't have exposure, very much exposure, to the periphery, but if you've got exposure to the banks in the core, and they've got exposure to the periphery, you've also got exposure to the periphery. And what I'm referring to is, for instance, our money market funds have probably close to $1 trillion deposited with European banks, and our banks have got huge exposure to France and Germany, not to mention derivative contracts that they might have written and about which we'll find out later, you know, when the crisis really gathers speed. So let me just go through the slides really to substantiate those bold kind of statements. And I would say start by, where do I point this?
Okay. Just to the right, probably point towards this.
Okay. So the reason that I say that this crisis is picking up speed, that it's intensifying, the first is you just take a look at a chart like this. This tells you that Greece's debt is reaching stratospheric levels that the IMF itself estimates that even if Greece does everything that the IMF says it should do, even if Greece begins to grow, which it's very unlikely to do, Greece's debt to GDP is going to peak at something like 180%, maybe go even higher to 200%. That is telling you that Greece needs a massive write-down in its debt, and I don't think that we're very far from that. When that occurs, the contagion that we already see in the markets is really going to get a lot more serious. You know, and what we do have is we already do have contagion. This chart just shows the rate of interest at which countries are borrowing, that you can see Portugal and Ireland already being hit by the Greek crisis, got problems of their own. But at the bottom, that of really great concern is Italy is now coming under real pressure. You know, today the interest rates are around about 7.5%. It's obvious that with Italy's debt at 120% of GDP, there's no way that Italy can sustain interest rates of that sort, and Italy really does pose an existential threat to the euro. Now, what else is going on in Europe is that the countries in the core look as if they're moving towards recession. You can see on the right, that chart is telling you that growth in countries like France and Germany has slowed substantially in the second quarter of 2011, but forward-looking indicators are telling you that Europe is now going to go into a meaningful recession. And the last indication that the crisis is really intensifying is that we're getting indications. I've just put up credit default swaps on banks as one indicator, but you're getting indications that a credit crunch is beginning in the heart of Europe, that banks are having to raise additional capital. They've got to try to get to capital ratios. What they're doing is they're shrinking their balance sheets. That is going to cause credit to be very scarce for countries like France and Germany. And if they engage in fiscal tightening with a credit crunch, you're really going to get a very meaningful recession in the core countries, which then makes it very difficult for the countries in the periphery to get out of their trouble. Now, many people would focus on the political weaknesses of the countries. You know, we've just seen what's going on in Greece in trying to form a government. We've seen Italy with all of the shenanigans. My point is that the economics is telling you that this crisis really has to go in a direction where you're going to get defaults and where you'll get the breakup. And basically, it's indicated in firstly in this chart. The key point is that countries have entered into a fixed exchange rate system, the most fixed exchange rate system that you can get. They've given up their currency, so they don't have control over interest rate policy. They can't devalue their currency, yet they haven't played by the rules of that currency arrangement. So what they've done is, whereas the rules of that arrangement said that they shouldn't run budget deficits more than 3% of GDP, the Maastricht criteria, the Stability and Growth Pact, countries ran budget deficits that were like 15% in the case of Greece, 14% in the case of Ireland. Spain really gets pretty high. So they developed really big problems in their public finances, their budget deficits way too high, their level of debt too high. So that's the first of the mistakes that they made. The second that's related is they lost a huge amount of international competitiveness. Over a 10-year period, countries like Greece and Portugal and Spain had consistently higher wage and price inflation than a country like Germany. So what it meant is over time, they lost a lot of competitiveness. They ran huge budget deficits. Where we are right now, of course, what occurs at because of that is they accumulate massive amounts of external debt, which when markets begin to get tight, it's difficult for them to roll over the debt because nobody is wanting to lend. Everybody's wanting to withdraw money. So you get a classic sudden stop where these countries run into a lot of difficulty. Where we are right now is this chart just encapsulates the public finances of a lot of these countries that after years of adjustment, they've still got budget deficits on the order of 10% of GDP, and their debt is way above 120, 150%, you know, levels that are not sustainable. So the essence of the problem right now is how do you correct those imbalances in a fixed exchange rate system? And essentially what the IMF and the EU are doing to these countries is they're telling them that the way to do this is through severe fiscal retrenchment and then adopt some structural reform that might produce good results in the long run, but in the short term is going to exacerbate the recession. So it's not a surprise, to me at least, that what you're getting is you're getting a country like Greece, the economy is literally in free fall. So the last four quarters, Greece's economy has contracted by 7.25%. The last 2 years, it's down by 12%. Greece isn't in a recession. It's in a major depression. When that occurs in Greece, what happens is that the tax base gets eroded, so the country doesn't meet the IMF budget targets. So the IMF shows up in town and tells the Greeks, you know what you need to do is you need to do more fiscal retrenchment. At this point, I normally tell the story that my father was a physician, and you know, I noticed as a child when my father used to prescribe medicine to a patient and he saw that the medicine was making the patient ill, generally what he did was he didn't double up the dose. What he did is he tried another medication, but it doesn't seem that this is what the IMF is doing in this country. And there are reasons for that. But you know, if you just look at a chart like this, Greece isn't the only country that's had output collapsing. You know, you've seen it in Ireland, you've seen it in Latvia, you're going to see it in Portugal in a big way. So there's something that's really very inconsistent. And what that does is it gives rise to huge amount of political anger, causes governments to fall, causes governments to lose their way. But I think that sticking with additional adjustment is simply not going to work. Now, what occurs is you get contagion to other countries. What the Europeans are trying to do is they're trying to spin the narrative that Italy and Spain are innocent bystanders. And you know, when I just look at a chart like this, this is hardly an innocent bystander. A country that's got a huge public debt to GDP problem, it's got excessive amount of public debt, it's now getting hit by a shock. And Italy can barely work if interest rates are 3 or 4%, but when interest rates go to 7.5%, it's quite another story. What you're seeing in Italy as well is if we look at the PMIs on Italy, that's the Purchasing Manager Index, this is just falling off a cliff. So what it means is Italy now is ready in recession, that the prescription for Italy will be budget tightening. You've got a credit crunch in Europe. I'm not sure that I see how all of this is going to work very happily. I'm not getting to the next slide. There were a few slides after this.
They have not shown up in this one.
Okay. That's fine. Don't worry about it. I can do without it. The issue is not so much what is occurring in the periphery, that really what counts is what is happening to the countries in the core, what is happening to their banking system. So while the countries in the periphery are relatively small, the amount of debt that they have is huge. And this is really where the threat, from a systemic point of view, comes about, is that a country like Greece might only be 1.5-2% of European GDP, but it has a debt that is $450 billion. If Greece defaults on the debt, as I fully expect it to do in relatively soon, I expect this to occur certainly within the next 3 to 6 months, that would constitute the largest default in history, that Argentina, Russia, they were only something like $100 billion. This, you're now talking about a $450 billion default. And what you're going to get, the ECB itself recognizes that if you get an event of that sort, ECB officials have been saying the past year that the European banking system could have its Lehman moment in the sense that you'd get contagion to Portugal, Ireland, Spain. If you take those four countries, you're talking about $2 trillion in debt. A lot of that is held with the European banking system. The IMF, in a recent calculation, came out with the notion that the European banking system is undercapitalized to the tune of 200 billion euro, whereas, in fact, the number is bound to be a lot higher, because what they're not taking into account is the effect of the recession that we're going to see in the core on regular bank losses. Let me just conclude by saying that the stakes are incredibly high. So given that what is at stake is a banking crisis potentially in Europe, the breaking up of the euro area, countries leaving a huge amount of defaults, what the officials are doing is you've got to expect that they're going to try to resist this. The only thing is that the efforts that they've made to date have been woefully inadequate. So, for instance, like what occurred last week, 10 days ago, is you had the European summit. They can see that the crisis is intensifying. They can see it's moving to Italy. So what they do is they come up with a plan that had three real components. One, they were trying to stabilize the Greek situation. Two, what they were trying to do is they were trying to get the banks to recapitalize themselves. And three, they were trying to build a firewall around Italy, you know, around Greece, so that when the Greek default occurred, that the French president indicated that, you know, Europe could live without Greece being in the euro, you know, indicating that they've now come to recognize that Greece is beyond salvation, you know, to keep it within the euro. What they wanted to do is they wanted to try to prevent this crisis from infecting Italy and Spain. Yet when they tried to build up their European Financial Stability Facility, they tried to build a firewall of €1 trillion, they to date have got no indication of how that is really going to take place. There's no concrete commitments to really do it. markets are correctly saying that a firewall of that size is probably half the size that it needs to be, and that money is also conditional. What is also occurring is that the capital requirements that they're asking the banks to get to capital ratios of 9%, how the banks are going to, they've given the banks till June 2012 to get to those ratios. What the banks are going to do is they're going to shrink their balance sheets. They're not going to raise capital at these very depressed stock prices. They don't want to dilute their shareholders. So what they're going to do is they're going to shrink the balance sheet, restrict lending, which is going to deepen the crisis. Final point I would make is that what the Europeans aren't taking into account is that even though they might be prepared to finance a country, if they're financing the country with conditions that the country considers onerous, what the country can choose to do, or its body politic can choose to do, is they can choose to default on the debt and withdraw from the euro. And I think that that's really where we're going in Greece. My read of Greece is that it's got striking resemblances to Argentina right now in the final days, that basically the Greeks are going to be saying that what the IMF EU is offering it is a deepening in its depression, absolutely no prospect of getting out of that depression for the next 10 years. They've got to be alternatives that they'll try. And I'm not suggesting that this is going to be easy for them to do, but I think certainly what you're going to see is you're going to see a hard default on the debt in the sense that they're going to write down that debt by 70, 80 cents on the dollar. And my view is that they'll, once they do that, they'll soon exit the euro, and then what we're going to see is we're going to see the contagion spreading. So if I haven't been clear, I would just conclude by saying I'm not optimistic about Europe's outlook.
Great to be here again. I think February when we had the last meeting, I was slightly more optimistic. And I think at this point I would come closer to Desmond's view. I also think this is really a case now where we're certainly at a threshold, in particular if Italy worsens from the position it is right now. I'm not sure the euro will collapse or disappear. Right? I think there's one option where there will be exits, but there will be a core euro, which in some sense would go back to what many people have argued in the run-up to the euro, that it should start smaller with a core and then expand more gradually for a variety of reasons. That didn't happen at that point, but there's still some outcome that is possible. I want to do so to raise three points. We have three speakers who have covered different areas, to talk a little bit about politics, talk about the expansion of the eurozone, which has not been covered recently as much, and then conclude, similar to what Desmond has done, of where are we right now and where are we going to. On the first part, my point was really to point I want to make is really that perhaps one thing we have learned or relearned in the last year, certainly I've relearned, how important it is to look at the capacity of countries to implement reforms in addition to whether there is an outright avenue towards reforms. Right? If we look at countries, certainly as Desmond has argued, we first have to look at the numbers. Right? And if the numbers don't add up, that's the end of the story. And for some countries right now, it's very hard to make the numbers add up. But beyond that, we have countries where one can reasonably make an argument that there are reform steps that would return these countries to a fiscally stable situation and growth. And I would think that Italy, for example, falls into that. One of the graphs that was shown is the U-curve. It's a famous U-curve where if you look at 1998 and you look at today, or 1997 and you look at today, many countries look quite similar. The debt level in Greece, the interest, so debt level in Italy, the interest rate in Italy actually look quite similar. Italy has worked at reasonably similar interest rates and reasonably similar debt levels for quite a while before the eurozone. So in that sense, there's some hope for stability. Of course, in the 10 years, a lot has changed. And I'm not an expert on Italy, but from what I read in the papers, it would seem that it's quite feasible to go over the Italian expenditure side and find a couple of percentage points that can be reduced without social misery, and likewise on the revenue side to find 1 or 2% as well. And the 3 and 4% turnaround in the Italian budget would do quite a lot. I think the question really, and what the market is asking, why the interest rates are up, is it likely that we will see that in a time frame that is likely to solve the problem. Right? And that partly goes back to what we've seen in Greece. and other countries. But I want to throw in a country that hasn't been mentioned today, which is Estonia. Right? It's noticeable that when the crisis started, we had 16 member states in the Eurozone. Today, we have 17. And there was one country that, in the midst of the crisis, said, well, we are going to meet the Maastricht criteria. We are going to get our deficit under 3%. And the country did it. Right? And I say country as well as government, because those are two, I think, very important elements to it. It was society as a whole which stood behind it, and the government delivered, and the government was re-elected. Right? And the Estonian output picture is also not pretty. Right? There were very significant cuts, very serious benefit reductions. But Estonia managed it, Estonia got through there, Estonia adjusted, and Estonia is now a thriving member, growing again rapidly, of the Eurozone. So that's one example of a country that clearly has a lot of capacity to adjust and sort of take short-term economic pain. Also a lot of advantages, not having debt to start with helps significantly in these sort of circumstances, of course. But it's a country that certainly has taken some bitter medicine and implemented a turnaround that is far larger than what Italy would need to do in some sense, in terms of percentages, but not absolute magnitudes. So it's interesting, I think, to look then at other countries and ask, well, how do we look at them in terms of capacity to adjust? And if you look, for example, at Ireland, it's pretty clear that Ireland gets a political bonus, if anything. And there's not much of a political risk premium for Ireland, yet the interest rates are very high, and I think that goes back to the numbers. The numbers in Ireland are just very, very high, so even a very well-meaning government will have a challenge dealing with that. Right? It's a lot that is happening outside. The powers of the government and contagion effects, et cetera, can overwhelm whatever Ireland can do domestically. But in other countries, one can ask, well, what is the capacity there? In France, the capacity surely is there. Right? France can adjust if it wants to adjust, and that shows up very much in the risk premium, which is very low. And in Italy, I think that's precisely the question markets ask right now. Does the Italian society / political system have the will and determination to take the steps that are needed right now when the crisis happens? So I think what is happening in Italy right now is that a short window of opportunity is opening up, where there is a possibility for adjustment, but if it's not taken, then these negative dynamics, I think, will make it extraordinarily difficult to stay within the range of numbers that make it sustainable. So we see that there. We then turn to another question, which is sort of membership. It should not be forgotten that official EU policy is for 25-member Eurozone. Right? Only two countries have an opt-out clause. Everyone else is expected to work towards Eurozone membership. That remains the official policy. And it's an interesting question to reflect what has actually happened the last few years in terms of the cost-benefit analysis. Right? Historically, the way we looked at that was to say there's a trade-off there. Right? Countries want to join a monetary zone because they get trade benefits from exchange rate stability, but they pay a cost in terms of asymmetric business cycle shocks. Right? The actual Eurozone experience was quite different. For one, until very recently, the business cycles were extremely highly correlated. Right, there was not really very much of an asymmetric shock. Now we have it. Right? Now we have the divergence between the north and the south that is huge. But a few years ago, that didn't happen. Right, so we had gains, but the gains were not really that much on the trade side. There was something there. The gains were primarily from that interest rate reduction, right? That famous U-curve again, right, where interest rates from everyone got basically to the level of Germany and now has diverged again. So if we look at it today, one of the main benefits from additional countries joining, which would be also to benefit from the substantial drop in long-term borrowing rates, is gone. That may be partly positive because if we look at what caused the crisis in many countries, it was related to that, right? The real estate booms, the asset bubbles in many countries contributed to the crisis that we see right now. Not in all, right? Italy, for example, used the benefit to some extent for fiscal consolidation. Right? In the middle of that U-turn, Italy looks much better than it does right now. That's partly because Italy took a good part of those long-term interest rate cuts to actually stabilize the budget to some extent and reduce the debt for a while. Right? That's now gone again, but it was there for a time. And so looking forward, if you look at potential member states, the question is, what is the cost-benefit we see now? Right? The interest rate gain is gone. If you look at exchange rate stability, and we look again at Greece, right, the answer must be, well, the benefits from stability are simply overwhelmed by the overvaluation effect. Right? The risk of ending up overvalued with a huge current account deficit must be larger than the benefit of increasing trade due to not having exchange rate variability. And that would be a strong lesson, I think, to draw, particularly for any large, more closed economy, not so much for the Estonians of this world, but for Portugal or Spain, that certainly is a serious danger. Right, so looking forward to cost-benefit analysis, in some sense, has shifted against membership. And that's an interesting sort of feature to keep in mind. One can turn it around also and ask for existing member states, what is the cost-benefit analysis? Right. Are they better off within or outside? Right, and that comes to the question of exit. And if we look at the literature on exit, it's really two separate questions. Right? One question we can ask is, if you take a hypothetical case, country A being in the eurozone or out of the eurozone, under what scenario is the country better off in terms of growth prospects, et cetera? Right? And the second part of the analysis is how costly it is to move from being inside the eurozone to being outside the eurozone. Right? And a good part of the arguments against exit is the second part, right, is that it's very, very costly to exit, not so much that countries would necessarily be much worse off on their own currency or floating rate, but rather it would be costly. And the costs are twofold, right? It's that it would lead to banking crisis, because even the belief that there might be an exit would force, would lead to massive withdrawals, leading to liquidity crisis and then responses. And then secondly, debt issues, right? That would lead to valuation issues if a country exits. Now, if you look at that in practice, I think one has to be very careful what the counterfactual is. Right? The counterfactual to not exiting is not necessarily that there are no costs, right? If you look at some of the countries that are in crisis, they are losing deposits, right? Banking system is already shrinking, so slow motion rather than in terms of a crisis, but there are exits there. Right? And on the valuation side, the question becomes, well, what happens once a country exits? Does it exit, or does it exit plus have a debt event of some sort, a haircut or something of the type? Right? And so there again, one can ask the question, what is the cost benefit of countries staying in the eurozone or getting out? And arguably, the case again for staying in is getting somewhat weaker as this slow crisis unfold in any case. Right. And then third part is sort of looking forward, where are we now? I think we're definitely at a tipping point. I agree that the next couple of months probably wouldn't even, might not even be 2012, next couple of months will be quite decisive. Something has to give, right? There are various options of making this hold, but all of them have severe drawbacks, right? One is the famous fiscal union. Right. That's not going to happen in any time frame that is reasonably close to resolve this particular crisis. And it's sort of unlikely to happen in the foreseeable future in any case, because it's opposed on both sides. Right? Those countries that are potentially beneficiaries of a fiscal union are well aware that would come with very significant conditions, that is to say, loss of national autonomy in fiscal matters. And we've seen in Greece that that is not something that goes down very, very easily. And on the other side, the contributor side, there's also, as we see in many countries now, opposition to increasing the amount of fiscal transfers. Right. The example often given is the United States, but that's not really the right example, right? Because the central government equivalent doesn't really exist in Europe, right? The EU only spends 1% of EU GDP, so it's the Commission. So it's a fairly small central government. It's not really the same structure, and it would be much, much more intrusive and direct. Right, so I don't think that is happening anytime soon. Second one is the EFSF versus other funds. But as Desmond said, right, the numbers aren't there. Right, there are ways to lever that up, but everywhere that is there to lever it up has strong opposition attached to it. And fundamentally, the issue is really that there's only two large countries standing inside the eurozone, which is Germany and France. And if all the debt from the other countries sort of migrates upward, what happens to the credit rating of those countries? Right. In France, it's already questions whether it's AAA or not. It's sometimes a debate. And it's simply the case that there's a limit to how much can move up the chain. So the money has to come from outside. Right? It has to come from the IMF, has to come from the US, has to come from China. And so we just don't see the money there. And so it's hard to make that. And that only leaves the ECB. And that's what currently the debate is. The ECB is happily buying bonds of Italy and Spain to the tune of billions a week. That is very controversial. The Germans sort of have, for historical reasons, 1923, an aversion against that happening. The question is it primary purchase or the purchases in the secondary market? But in a situation where many banks are weak and dependent on government support, that sort of argument is also becoming less hard to sustain. So it's building a lot of unease against continued large purchases of government bonds by the ECB. Yes, it's okay on the margin to stabilize interest rate, but if the other buyers are gone, or if the other parties become sellers, then the magnitude that can be reached will probably have very significant political repercussions within the ECB. We've already seen that with the resignation of the previous German representative, with the decision of Axel Weber not to run for president, etc. So there are certainly political issues within the ECB as well that make it unlikely that that happens in the future. So the only way then to really go forward is either to have the ECB take that role, which would take a very large change in sort of Germany's policy approach. Could happen, we don't know yet. Or the alternative that Desmond mentioned eventually. Right? There's relatively little, I think, between those two, unless a large external actor comes in and actually provides those funds. But so far, there's no evidence on that. So it would also be slightly on the more pessimistic view. But I think what we may actually see is a smaller surviving euro that eventually actually will become stronger. So in that sense, I would be a little bit more optimistic. I wouldn't say survive, I would say smaller. Okay. So thank you very much.
So, thanks very much for having me. I'm not a Euro expert like the previous two speakers. I'm somebody who tries to work around with models, and I'll show you some few forecasts and talk a bit about some of the same issues that Desmond and Holger brought up. If we actually had this subscription to the model that I'm going to show you some of the results for, we could actually do some of this real time. But Mike has been cheap, and he won't give me the subscription money to buy the forecast so that we could actually do this in classes. But we're pushing for it, and he's pushing for it. He's trying. So you're at the crossroads. I was trying to figure out, well, you know, what are the crossroads here? I guess we're thinking about Greece and Italy, and so it's the choice of one olive or two, or, you know, the old saying, shaken and stirred is the European economy right now. So that's, oh, geez, now you really got me. Nope. All right. Nope. There we go. So all roads lead to, well, maybe it's Athens, maybe it's, this is from The Economist. Here's a picture that sort of Desmond was telling us about what's been happening in the Greek economy. This red line here shows us what's been happening in terms of total industry output. They're down over 25% from 2009, and it's not going to get better. Similarly, sort of retail trade, it's collapsed to only about 20%, then will get worse. So I think what we all should be doing is planning for that place on a Greek island that we've all wanted to have at some point or other in our lifetimes. Well, one of the things here is that they've, as Desmond was sort of mentioned, two decades, and they're essentially lost. They haven't gone anywhere. They got up high when sort of the euro first started working out. They were good for about a decade, and then it's just collapsed. And that's in part because of, you know, how they tricked their colleagues into letting them in. Well, then we've got the other component here, the Berlusconi miracle. Two decades, and you could look at employment numbers here. You could look at all kinds of fun things here. And essentially, the miracle has not happened. It's also two lost decades. Now, I'm not saying that these are the only countries that are like this, but there are some issues. So some of the outlook. I'm going to show you kind of two basic forecasts from Oxford Economic Forecasters. Their sort of baseline forecast says that, you know, Europe muddles through. There's going to be a bit of a default in Greece, but some of these risk premium, I wasn't able to get some of these interest rate data, the most recent ones, in part because I don't have the subscription, and the other sources I have weren't updated quickly enough. But what's happening to risk premia? They may be falling, and that will allow these countries to fund their financial deficits and so forth a little bit better. We do have the high debt problems, the emerging markets. They're going to continue to grow, but perhaps not as rapidly. And I would actually argue that I think the models are a little bit more optimistic than I would be about this situation. So here with Europe, there is going to be the haircut, probably at least 50%, probably by January or so forth. There's going to be a small default of some form. There is going to be some contagion, but it's presumed that the ECB, which has essentially been the only player in these markets, is going to continue to be, and somehow they're going to get through all of this. So what does that mean for world GDP growth? This blue line shows us historically what was happening through 2010 and then what people were predicting. And the red line shows us, well, what the forecasts are now. We're a full percentage point below what economic growth was hoped for globally, from a year ago. And this is in part because of what's been happening in the US, what's been happening in Europe, and even some activity that's been going on in China. Show you a few pictures of economic growth outlook from the US. This is from different sources. The first column is from the most recent FOMC meeting by the Fed. I took the midpoint of the various central ranges, and if the economy goes as they hope, we might get 1.7% this year. They're thinking 2 and 3, or almost 3% for the next few years. Good luck. Then here's the most recent IMF. I wasn't able to get their more recent regional forecast. They're a little bit more sanguine than the US. The survey of professional forecasters is one I actually contribute to, but this one only comes from August. We just submitted Monday our forecast. This is a group of about 45 people that try to, you know, make guesses of what's going to happen in the US economy. So we don't have the summary numbers out. Maybe we'll get them by Friday or next Monday. A little bit slower growth, and then Oxford Economic Forecast suggests about a little bit more optimistic than the IMF, but then appears to be strong growth. Well, growth is good. What about unemployment? Unemployment is not good. It looks like we'll be at least two more years of 8% plus unemployment. I'd actually suggest, unfortunately, it's going to be longer than that. For the last 2 years, I've been far more pessimistic about unemployment than others, and it seems like now I'm almost in the mid-range. I hate to say it. Here's a picture of what's going on in the U.S. for the last 20 years or so. What's happened with us? The blue line here shows what, you know, economists call this potential GDP. And if you ever see it, please come tell me what it is, because I'd love to find it. But this comes from the CBO. And the red line shows what's actually been happening. And what you can see since the recession is that the economy is almost 7% below potential. And it's not clear. There's some models, including the CBO right now, under the rules of which they have to make projections, that they think we'll be back to the potential growth rate by 2015, 2016. Good luck. There was a recent conference up at the Boston Fed, and there reasonable people were saying maybe by the end of the decade. The gap here is nearly $1 trillion out of an economy that is almost $14 trillion. We are not performing well. Now, again, this is GDP. The real thing here is jobs. We have a lost decade ourselves in jobs. This is non-farm employment. Beginning of 2000, we were almost up to 132 million people employed. Today, it's about 131.5 million people employed. We just haven't been able to generate the jobs, and we're losing them. You've probably all seen these reports on not only unemployment, but unemployment duration, and so on and so forth. It's not a pretty picture. Oh, back to Athens and Rome, which what's going to happen? Eurozone financial contagion. So now I'm going to sort of put together some of the stories that would produce a forecast. So it could be that the debt restructuring does occur, but the Greeks just cannot get their financial house in order, and I just don't believe they can do it. And I mean, it's not that they're unwilling. I just think that the economy will implode. You're going to get much higher unemployment. People, most of your age, are voting with your feet in Greece right now. You're moving to Paris. You're moving to Frankfurt. You're moving to London. Anywhere, but Athens. Okay, you don't want to be stuck there. We'll have loan losses, as was mentioned, and I'll show you some ideas about this. Again, here's this picture that everybody shows about driving debt, so I'll skip that one. The big issue here that both of the speakers were talking about is that so many of the countries have to be engaged in fiscal contractionary policy. Now, what we all know in this room is that contractionary policy in the short run has negative effects on economic growth. This is not like one of the congressional plans that was put out earlier this year that said, oh, if we cut government spending today, economic growth will grow today. That's not going to happen. That's fundamental principles. And here you see Greece, you see Ireland, contractions of 10, 15, 20%. I don't think that's me. Anyway, I'll skip over this because we don't really have time for this. Desmond was mentioning about the exposure. And here's the exposure of banks, private banks in the various countries, to debt in the peripheral countries, Greece, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Portugal, I guess it is. I want you to just focus on the bottom ones here. Japan maybe is $100 billion exposed to this. In the U.S., we're nearly $750 billion, and the rest of the world that we know of is $750 billion. The red here is government debt, purple is private sector, and the other, we just don't know for sure, but supposedly it's there. If the problems occur in Europe, it's not only going to cause, or in these peripheral countries, it's not only going to cause the problems, as Holger mentioned, to the banking sector in Germany and France, but it's also going to have a big impact over into the United States and the rest of the world. Our banks are going to have to find ways of raising funds to be able to continue to operate. So what happens if there is a default? This is one scenario that comes from the Oxford Economic Forecasting Model for what happens in Europe. If the default occurs and we have the contagion along the lines that Desmond was referring to, we go from, in 2013, positive growth of 2% down to almost negative growth of 3%. This is going to be a disaster, and as Holger suggested, there's going to be musical chairs in the European community. What happens in the U.S.? What happens in the rest of the world? Our growth was supposedly going to be about 3%. We go to nothing. And what happens with that is greater job losses, higher unemployment, and more people unemployed for longer periods of time. Remember, in the U.S., unemployment right now, more than half the people who are unemployed, this is about 14 million, have been unemployed for more than 6 months. There's about a quarter of them have been unemployed for a year and a half or more. This is not good. And we're not even talking about people who get discouraged. What happens in the rest of the world? We go from 4% growth down to about 1% growth. This contagion is real, and it will have tremendous effects. This growth, this macroeconomic model that I'm referring to, is really driven by international trade and trade linkages across the countries. That's what this Oxford model does best at. It captures the trade flows and some of the financial flows. The individual countries may not be as useful, but within the trade component, it's absolutely phenomenal. I'm going to skip some of this, I think, and just try to end on a positive note, because we've had lots of gloom and doom here and so forth. If we believe, and I've looked, if one looks at some of the more recent IMF stuff, if someone looks at some of the CBO and let's say macro advisors or IHS Global Insight, these numbers, they're about the same. So we're all making the same mistakes, as people know, like good forecasters are. Growth in the US, maybe 2.5%. In the Eurozone, 1.5%. For the world as a whole, it's probably going to be close to 4%. It's going to be declining from what it was, what it had been of 5 and 6%, or almost 5% historically. And, you know, as Holger was mentioning, we've got this political solution in Europe that needs to be solved, and we'll find out if it works. Thanks very much.